and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. We've got a great show for you. We're going to talk a little about a non-crop topic today, spraying shelter belts and just overall tree management and maybe even spraying around the yard a little bit too. If you've got any questions for us, whether it's on your farm, in your yard, in your shelter belts, whatever, be more than happy to take your phone call. Our number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. You can email us, radio@agphd.com, or find us on Twitter, agphdmedia, Darren Hefty, or Brian Hefty. Well, we are live in the Morton studio today, and we're going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag just about right away here. I was just going to say we're right now in the middle of May, and this is the time of year when it seems like we get the most agronomic questions. It's just a lot of fun talking about all these challenges that come up and opportunities that come up. It's very easy to look at commodity prices today and you say, well, I give up. There's no chance of making money. But when you actually run some numbers and you start going through stuff, there are ways that you can minimize loss or maximize profit, however you want to look at it. We all have to hope that things turn out well. And I was talking to a guy just last week, and I said, you know, from any time before 2007 on the farm, there was no year at the start of the year we could pencil out making money for sure, and I'm dead serious. No year where we could make money from when I started back on our farm in 1991 until 2006. Every single one of those years at the beginning of the year, I talked to my dad, and I'm like, it looks pretty lean on the farm here, Dad. He's like, yep. We're hoping for the best. We're just going to do the best thing that we can. And, you know, every day we have to make decisions, not necessarily based on cutting costs, but on minimizing our costs, yet maximizing our yields. And every decision that we need to make on the farm, it's got to pay its own way. So if, for example, we're going to spray a fungicide, we say, I realize it costs whatever, $5 or $10. I don't mind spending the money. I mean, most people are going to say, well, just cut the cost. But if it can give us a positive return on investment, so if I only spend $5, and even if it gives me back 8 or 10 or 12, whatever, I just made more money. And that's the way we've always tried to look at things, and that's kind of the way we've talked about it here on Ag PhD many, many times. So we just have to look at how can we profit. All right, let's get to the Ag PhD mailbag.
It's the mailbag!
All right, Brian, first question comes from Eric in New York, and we got a couple of 2,4-D questions I'll give you in a row. Eric's first. He said, I'm mostly an organic grower, but there are times. That said, can you please give me the name of the 2,4-D that doesn't have odor? Well, I think you're talking about the new 2,4-D choline, yeah. And Freelex is the product that we would normally talk about in Enlist crops. We talk about Enlist 1. Same active ingredient. The Enlist one just has an additional drift retardant. So those products would be great. And you're right. There's definitely an odor difference when you're spraying the old formulations of 2,4-D. 2,4-D choline is much, much better. Thanks, Eric. Really appreciate the question. Got this one from Zeus, who says, so conventional corn, if my only goal is broadleaf control, can 2,4-D be part of the solution early?
Nope. 2,4-D can't be part of your burn down, can't be part of your pre, can't be part of your post. 2,4-D should not be a part of your weed control program at all. Now, here's the good news. Yep, I said 2,4-D is out. And most likely, the reason why you're thinking 2,4-D is because of the image in your mind of, well, 2,4-D is cheap. Well, dicamba is just as cheap, and it's better, and it's safer. So why would you not use dicamba? That would be my suggestion, if you want to go cheap. Now, there are other things you can use that are also super inexpensive. For example, the HPPD herbicides are cheaper yet. They're cheaper than 2,4-D or dicamba and have residual and are better on a lot of weeds. So it all depends on what your weed spectrum is. But quite frankly, if you're trying to do this thing cheap, HPPD is probably the way to go. And by HPPD, what I'm talking about there is all those Some of the names that you might be familiar with are Callisto, Impact, Armazon, Laudis. Those are all in that HPPD chemistry.
All right. Thanks for the question, Zeus. Appreciate that. This one comes from Matt, and he's in West Central Iowa, and he's got some burr cucumber issues. He said, the past few years I've had real issues with burr cucumber popping up in my pivot tracks. The corn stays weed-free until about mid-August, and then we have some problems. So I'm wondering if there's a residual I could put into my post-mix to help hold these guys down. These fields are corn on corn. So my current plan is I put down a full rate of Harness Extra and a full rate of Roundup. Then post-emerge, I come back with 3 ounces of Callisto, half a pound of atrazine, full rate of Roundup with my fungicide and micro pack around V5, V6. And then mid-August, it starts to break. I've got 200 acres that have this problem now. The rest of the farm, which is nearly 2,000 acres, hasn't had a problem. I'd love to get it under control when it's just in this small amount of acres. You know, burr cucumber's tough.
And well, yeah, but he's doing the best thing that he can for burr cucumber pretty much.
For the most part. Well, here's what I'd change, Brian. You could use Verdict down up front, so you had Sharpen out there.
Yep.
That would be something that may help you, and I'd run with the strong rate of Verdict, so you've got, what's the strongest rate you can run in corn? 15, 16 ounces, something like that, where you got 3 ounces of Sharpen.
Yeah, 15 would give you 3 ounces.
That would be my thought. I'd start with that. I'd save that atrazine for the post-emerge application in corn on corn. Are you fine with a full pound of atrazine going out there with Callisto? Could you use like an Acuron type product where you'd have a stronger rate?
No, I'm not
going to
do that. It's going to cost way more money. But I would take a look at spraying my HPPD a little bit later. The other thing you could do is split it up. You could go half and half or two-thirds rate twice or something like that. But get a later spray. You got to do something later. But it's hard because there's nothing there. When there's no crop canopy, you're going to have weeds.
And when it's in those wheel tracks, that's a little tricky. I don't know if anyone's ever tried putting a spray nozzle on those wheel tracks or just sending somebody through there. That would be
the way to go.
And thanks for the question, Matt. We'll be right back after this.
You're all set with the 4x4 turbo diesel truck. How about some options? Spray and bed liner?
Absolutely.
Tailgate step and Nerf bars?
Gotta have them.
Tie down hooks and stainless steel toolbox?
You know it.
Tinted windows?
Of course.
Options are good. That's as true in the field as it is with your pickup. In addition to taking care of tough weeds, new Open Sky herbicide gives you more rotational choices than ever before and an easy-to-handle formulation.
Gooseneck tow package?
Yep.
Discover more Open Sky details at openskyherbicide.com.
Worried about glyphosate-resistant weeds and grasses in your corn? Unleash the power of new Impact Z herbicide and get the early post-application advantage you've been waiting for. Save $3 per acre when you combine Impact Z with a qualifying insecticide purchase. Go to buy2save3.com for details. Buy2save3 is a service mark, and Impact Z is a trademark owned by Ambac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
It came in waves, ruthlessly eliminating the new spectrum of hard-to-kill grassy weeds in wheat. Everest 3.0 herbicide. A new formulation makes it brutal on yellow foxtail, foxtail barley, and other tough grasses. Everest 3.0 gets the weeds you see and the ones you know are coming, with flush-after-flush control. Ask your retailer about Everest 3.0. Wave after wave of grassy weed domination. Always read and follow label directions.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today, taking your calls and questions all throughout the show at 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can email us radio@agphd.com. Our topic today is spraying your shelter belts. Real happy to have Arnold Broadbeck with us right now down at Auburn University. Arnold, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, it gets to be a little tricky when we're spraying for weeds in shelter belts. I mean, if you're out in a cornfield, no problem. You can spray all over the place, but when you've got desirable trees there, it's a little more tricky. So talk to me about that. In the state of Alabama, I think about humidity and heat and all the things that growers there are dealing with. How do you take care of those shelter belts and take care of weeds out there too?
So, you know, when you're applying herbicides around trees, there's a few, you know, key things to keep in mind. A lot of the herbicides we use are very useful. They can do a lot of good in our cropping systems. But when sometimes we get them on plants we didn't wish to get them on, you know, it can lead to some challenges for us. And so, you know, one of the things is a lot of our herbicides, you know, have different modes of activity. So that means, you know, some of them, if you spray them on the green leaves, it's absorbed through the leaves and it's translocated through your plants. And so if you're using those herbicides, you know, avoid spraying on windy days because you might have that drift blow onto a plant you didn't wish to get it onto. And so it's one of the kind of the keys to watch out for. The other one is to remember to read your label carefully. You know, we're constantly having, you know, new chemistry come out with herbicides, and sometimes they're mixing different products. And occasionally we end up with products that are soil active. And that basically means that as well as being foliar, the trees can and the plants can absorb it through their root systems. And I see that one getting people in trouble quite often. Because what happens is we get something, we spray it, and people don't realize how far a tree's root system can extend. And trees' root systems often go 2 to 3 times the drip line. And so if you have high-value trees, those trees that just shelter belts that you really want to keep in place, if you're using something that you know is soil active, stay 2 or 3 times the drip line away from that tree because you're trying to avoid that root system absorbing that herbicide and leading to damage.
Yeah, that's a great tip, and I think about that a lot. Those root systems are enormous, and we certainly see them when there's trees along the side of fields, for example, how far those roots head out into the field searching for water and for nutrition. Now, when we're looking at weed control, that's one thing. How about insects that are impacting trees? Are there some key ones in Alabama that you're watching out for? And if so, what are the methods and timings for treatment?
Sure. So, you know, it depends on the species of trees. You know, insects usually are adapted to a certain species of tree. So if you have, you know, shelter belts that are made up of pine species, we had a drought last year. We already had a bit of a dry spring this year. And when you have those types of conditions, pine bark beetles become a major concern. They can come in. They're going to be attracted to those stressed trees. Drought produces stress. So what you can do to help prevent that is make sure those trees have plenty of growing space. You want to open up those shelter belts a little bit. So as they maybe get overcrowded, as your crowns of the trees start really getting tight, you can might consider thinning them out, giving those trees enough space to grow. Other pests that we have on the horizon are emerald ash borer. It's been a major issue in the Midwest, in the Northeast. It has now made its way into Alabama. If you have ash trees in your shelter belts, you're certainly going to be wanting to pay attention as to where the front for emerald ash borer is and either think about planting a tree that's more resistant in the future or thinking of using some of the systemic insecticides that can help prevent that pest in the future.
Yeah, we've got emerald ash borer in our area here in South Dakota, and I know just in my yard I've got a couple of ash trees, and I've been treating them now for the last couple of years to make sure we're avoiding that issue. So, yeah, it's a big concern over a broad geography. How about with mites? Do you have a lot of mites down in Alabama that you have to worry about in trees?
You know, we do, but when we start looking at a lot of those pests that can be foliar, whether we're talking about, you know, aphids or mites or sometimes even some of the scale bugs, they can sometimes make your trees, or even some of the caterpillars, they can make your trees, they can sometimes defoliate trees or a portion of the tree, but a lot of times they're more of an eyesore than really having any long-term health impacts on the trees. And so I like to tell people if it's a foliar disease, if you've got, you know, some tent caterpillars, or you have some type of a fungal disease that's just affecting and causing a little bit of leaf drop 1 year, 1 year is not a problem. It's when it becomes 2 years, 3 years in a row, that continued defoliation, that you need to start paying attention. But a lot of times these pests, they'll come in, hit the tree 1 year, following year they're not there, and you don't have to really worry about it. So a lot of times non-treatment is really the answer, unless it becomes a multi-year issue.
Okay, I haven't spent a lot of time in Alabama out in tree belts, but I have in Mississippi. And one thing that I found plenty of, I was careful, but I did see it out there, was poison ivy. Is that a big concern in your state? And what do you do about that?
Sure. I mean, you get out in the Alabama woods and you're going to find, you know, poison ivy. Number one, be able to identify it. So you're looking for those three, you know, leaves to a stem. The leaves are kind of mitten-shaped, oftentimes what we call lobed. White berries, they are deciduous, which means in the wintertime they're not going to have leaves. And as far as what to do about it, you know, you can, if it's a vine that's coming up your tree, I really wouldn't consider using a herbicide. You run the risk that if you spray the side of a tree, the trunk of a tree, especially a thin-barked species, that herbicide actually could be absorbed by that tree. So my recommendation is if it's on the ground, away from the tree, you can spray it with something like glyphosate, knock it back. If it's a vine on the tree, just using something like a machete or an axe, just cut the vine back. Just be aware that the sap can also be an irritant. So you want to be careful that you don't get that sap on you.
You know, the other question I get, since you mentioned an axe, I was thinking about pruning trees as well. Is this, what is the timing for things in Alabama with pruning trees? I'm assuming that timing may be passed already for this spring, but what is your normal recommendation?
So, you know, ideally, perfect world scenario, you want to prune your trees in the dormant season. So in the winter, down here in the south. So, you know, when your trees are dormant, and you really want to avoid pruning, if you can, in the spring, because the trees are, you know, pushing sap flow up, they're pushing energy out into developing new leaves, and if you cut at that time, the trees might bleed a little bit, and you're also just causing the tree to invest in a branch that you then are going to remove. And so, ideally, you want to prune in the winter. However, once spring's kind of over, and if you've got something you need to prune, in most cases, unless you're in an area with oak wilt, you really don't need to worry about pruning in the summer. You can prune normally with any given tree. You don't want to take off more than about 20 to 25% of the canopy in one single year.
Okay, last question for you. If we're establishing a new tree belt, how big a deal is fertility?
So, you know, it can be a pretty big deal. I mean, if you're looking at ag fields, I'm gonna guess that most of your ag fields are going to be pretty good. A lot of the soils I deal with are urban, which are not the best soils in the world. So soil test first. You know, get an idea of what's going on with your soil, particularly your pH. And so once you have an idea of what your pH is, that can help you guide what tree you might select for that site, finding the right tree for that site. Because if you get the wrong tree that's not adapted either to an acidic soil or a basic soil, you're going to be fighting those pests. You're going to be fighting slow growth, and you're not going to get the results you want. So soil test first, and then when you plant the tree, don't fertilize the first year. Wait one whole year and start fertilizing the second year. And just fertilize based on what is needed by the soil test. But avoid the first year. You know, a lot of times the first year, especially with nitrogen, they're pushing the extra growth.
Yes.
And the
yes.
tree can be investing in its root system.
Well, you're speaking our language, Arnold. We're talking to Arnold Broadbeck with Auburn University. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Find your full potential and increase your bottom line with branded generic fungicides from Atticus LLC. Fungal diseases can be devastating, but Acadia, Slant, and Talaris 4.5F from Atticus deliver lasting, broad-spectrum fungi control so your soybeans, sugar beets, and dry beans can thrive. Growers across the region count on Atticus for relevant and reliable products that deliver results every time. Ask your local retailer about Atticus products and visit atticusllc.com to learn more. For value-based solutions you can trust, turn to Atticus. Always read and follow label instructions.
Hey, Adam, new drone?
Not just any drone.
I mounted a laser on it to take out weeds.
Look out for that tree.
In the power lines!
Oh, it's heading for the house.
There's a simpler way to protect spring wheat from weeds. Perfect Match Herbicide. The broadest spectrum weed and grass control in one product. Learn more at PerfectMatchHerbicide.com. Always read and follow label directions.
The laser.
Before it's too late and white mold becomes a problem, you need to ask your seed dealer for heads-up seed treatment. When raising soybeans in the Midwest, you know the risk of being caught unprepared. As heard on AgPHD, there are several steps you can take prior to planting for a successful management plan against white mold. Compatible and cost-effective season-long protection starts now by asking your seed dealer to apply Heads Up to your 2020 bean seed order. For more information, visit headsupst.com.
If you're looking to get the most out of your foliar nutrition and fungicide programs, ask your ag retailer about Nutex EDA from Sipcam Agro. Nutex EDA has been proven to increase foliar micronutrient tissue levels and maintain those levels for an extended period of time. When tank mixed with fungicides, Nutex EDA helps support plant health, resulting in higher quality and yields. Nutex EDA is an affordable and effective solution that should be part of every grower's high-yield toolbox.
When it comes to my weed control, I know a head start can go a long way. That's why I spray early, so I can keep control all season long with a Roundup Ready Extend crop system, the system that makes the difference. This is my field.
Choose the Roundup Ready Extend crop system for control of more weeds than any other soybean system. Featuring Extendamax herbicide with vapor grip technology to manage tough-to-control weeds, including up to 14 days of soil activity, along with the field-proven performance of Roundup Ready to Extend soybeans. Now you have the right tools to extend your weed control and extend your yield with the system that makes the difference. Learn how you can put the system to work in your field when you visit RoundupReadyExtend.com. Extendamax is a restricted-use pesticide. Performance may vary. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. Check local regulations for specific requirements in your state.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're broadcasting from the Morton studio, talking about spraying in your shelter belts, but also taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. You can also email us radio@agphd.com or find us on Twitter, AgPhD Media, Brian Hefty or Darren Hefty. Let's head out to Pennsylvania. We've got Kevin with us right now. Kevin, how are you today?
Good, Darren. How are you doing?
Doing well, doing well. You know, on the farm, we get so busy about getting the crop in and getting everything cared for. Eventually, those questions come around to spraying shelter belts. And have we missed the boat already? Have we already missed the best timing to take care of things out in the trees?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's getting pretty late here. And, of course, the weather's been such an issue with, I think, anybody in this area that being timely on it just hasn't presented itself. So.
No, that's for sure. Even some of the trees in our area have really started slow this year, just with all the cool weather we've had. What's it looking like there in Pennsylvania?
So, same thing. You know, we started out not so bad into April, and then all of a sudden it got really cold. Temperatures came down, a lot of rain, and then we had some frost. So, when trees started budding out here, they got clipped by the frost pretty hard in places. So, you know, we've seen some damage in that regard.
So what do you expect to see then for these trees that I know we were talking about too, and we just missed it right where we're at. We stayed warm enough. The trees survived and we didn't lose everything that had already gotten going in the spring. But what happens with those trees? They just take another month or two to get coming again, or is it a whole nother year before they really recover?
So, yeah, I mean, from my experience, it depends on the species of tree. Some do take another month or so to finally catch up, and then they do okay. And then there's some that, gosh, they can go one of two ways. They can completely die out and just miss it, or, you know, they're not going to put anything out that year, and they come back the following year, but you just don't see any action out of them for that year. They're just stunted so badly.
Unfortunately, our corn isn't like that. We lose a couple leaves, and they start growing right away again. How about your soybeans? Did you have any soybeans that were up before that frost?
No, we haven't. We just got going on corn, really, and then we got shut down by that cold weather. We got some corn in the ground, actually, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, here we go. It's going to take that cold drink of water and not survive. But it emerged. It's looking okay. So, but to answer your question, we have not gotten to the soybeans, and I'm probably looking at maybe having a custom planter guy plant for me just to get those beans in and before we miss the window.
Yep. Yeah, I don't blame you about that at all. Back to the trees. In our area, emerald ash borer is getting all the attention. How about in Pennsylvania? Are there some issues going on in some of the shelter belts that people should be aware of?
Yeah, so there are some issues, but we mostly saw that emerald ash borer really take hold. It's probably been 3 or 4 years ago where they were pretty bad. They have slacked off a little bit, but they're still here. You know, they're just not as you know, prevalent. You don't see them as much.
You know, we look at our shelter belts around the farm, and I know sometimes we'll see some weeds out there, and we're used to seeing our crop ground weed-free, and we'd love to see those shelter belts weed-free. Our timing is generally April and October that we're the most aggressive. We kind of feel like this new 2,4-D choline that doesn't have all the volatility might give us an option to be out there even in season, but I guess we'll see how that plays out this year. How about for you? What do you like to do out in shelter belts, and are there some weeds or other problems out there that you're generally addressing?
Yeah, honestly, same thing as what you're doing. The new style 2,4-D is, I think, the way to go. Again, timing is crucial, but that's the way we're approaching it. You know, if we have some good grass growing in there and choke those weeds out, that's nice. But you know, that's a perfect world, and we don't live in that perfect world. So yeah, basically same as what you're doing, just hitting it with that 2,4-D and hoping for the best.
Outstanding. Any agronomic struggles you're having out in the crop ground this year? Any big agronomic questions you've been thinking about?
Yeah, I almost know the answer to it, but it's just so much water. We've had so much rain, and you think, well, Pennsylvania, you got all those hills, but gosh, if that stuff doesn't just boil out of the hills at times, and it'll stay wet forever, it seems. So we know we need to get tiling. That's been a huge issue, and we have tiled some of our farms, but just not enough, and that's our biggest struggle right now, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's definitely an improvement here for our farm, and I know a lot of growers in our region are fighting the same thing. If they've got tile in the ground, they've pretty much got the stuff planted, and it looks good. If they don't have it, once again, we've got areas out here in the Dakotas that are really struggling and have had so much moisture in some cases for multiple years. It's really tough. Talking with Kevin in Pennsylvania, same kind of challenges we're fighting here, but battling through things. Kevin, good luck to you as you get those soybeans in, and hope to talk to you again sometime soon.
Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you.
You bet. Thanks. Let's head over to Ohio. We've got Larry with us right now. Larry, how you doing?
Pretty good. It's raining here pretty good. We've been getting good rains here over the last couple of days, but I got a question here on a government filler strip that I put in 2 years ago, and it's really got good clover in it, and it's got grass seed that the government recommended putting on the filler strip along the ditch. But anyhow, I see a lot of thistles coming up in this filler strip, and what I want to know what I can use so I don't kill the grass and the clover in the filler strip. And control the thistles.
Yep, Larry.
And my second question.
Oh, go ahead. Yep.
My second question, I got these Christmas trees coming on them. Really little. They just come up now. They're about 4 or 5 inches tall, and they only get about a foot tall when they mature. They're in my cornfield along the road. And I was wondering, I think you know what I'm talking about there. I wonder how you can control them.
Now, are you talking actual trees, or are you talking a weed that looks like a tree?
It's a weed that looks like a Christmas tree. It's a little, it's just
like Russian
stick
thistle, maybe.
It looks like a branch.
Oh,
there's probably a name. Huh?
Well, wait a second though. It has no leaves on it.
No, they're...
It does have leaves.
It's like a Christmas tree, what you call
it? Kind of neat. It looks like almost little needles. Yeah. So that's probably Russian thistle. Yep, Russian thistle. Yeah. Okay, so let's handle the easy one first. Russian thistle, and this what you refer to as like looks like Christmas trees in corn. Yeah. Just about any broadleaf killer will do it in corn. The best one is Status, but that costs about probably $16 an acre. Otherwise, you could run out there with an HPPD like Callisto or Laudis or something like that for $3-4, along with maybe a half pound of atrazine. So I'm not too worried about the Russian thistle. That you can control. My biggest concern with that, though, is if those are already 8 inches tall, that's getting to a stage where you got to hit them now, and even then you might not kill every last one. That's why I might consider spraying the Status, because that should take them out 100%. The HPPD together with atrazine, I don't think would do quite as good, especially as they're starting to get that big. But lots of things you can kill that with in corn, so I'm not too concerned about that. Now, your other question in terms of how do we kill actual thistles like Canada thistle or something out of a clover grass strip, there is no answer. The clover is the problem. Grass, we got lots of things. I mean, there's no problem at all to go kill thistles in grass. I'd use Milestone probably if that was the case. If it's just going to be permanent grass, you can wipe that out with 7 ounces of Milestone. Doesn't cost all that much money, and your thistles are permanently gone. But with that clover in there, that's the trouble, because every thistle killer that I can think of anyway also kills clover.
Okay, I got a question. I forgot what I was going to ask here.
Oh, so
you could spot spray for those thistles, Brian. That way you wouldn't wipe out all the clover.
That's what I was just going to say, is what you could do is go out like with a four-wheeler. If you've got a tank with Roundup in it, mix the Roundup up strong and not a lot of water or anything, and just go squirt each individual thistle. That would be your best way to go in that strip. Hey, Larry, if you've got another question for us, just hang on for us. We got to take a quick break here. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Revitech fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean fields, you don't have to think about them at all. With 2 effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer amaranth. Take control of your soybean fields and get incentives from Bayer Plus Rewards when you choose the power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
We planted early February, we have all good emergence. So far, we can't find any condition that the wheels haven't worked. I can just say that.
closing the seed trench behind the planter is essential to establishing yields in the fall. Introducing the Germinator Closing Wheel from Farm Shop MFG. Designed and built by a farmer who is tired of seeing poor stands because of uneven emergence, the Germinator is here to give your crop the strong start it needs for maximum yield. For more information, visit us at farmshopmfg.com.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? Brian Ryberg from Buffalo Lake, Minnesota has done just that. Here's his story.
We began using a Soil Warrior on our farm the fall of 2014. We've seen many benefits from better water infiltration, a lot less hours on equipment, fuel, being able to reduce our fertilizer side. So it's really simplified our operation.
See what makes Soil Warrior different and better at SoilWarrior.com.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here, along with my brother Darren. We're live in the Morton studio today, and right before the break, we were talking to Larry from out in Ohio, just about a couple of issues that he had on his farm. Larry, go ahead. It sounded like you wanted to talk about Bassegran on thistles.
Yes, a fellow farmer told me not to kill the clover or the grass. He said use Bassegran, but do it when the thistles are in a bud stage, and he said that would kill them forever. Now, I'm thinking about that. Wouldn't that be the same as using on your soybeans? Where you are? What's that product? Not Roundup on your soybeans. It burns it down.
You aren't talking Liberty, are you? But
Liberty, yeah.
Oh,
wouldn't that be the same as using Liberty on them? That burns them right down too, but it don't kill them. It just rid of them and.
Yeah. Okay, so here's what we can tell you, because both Darren and I have lots of years of experience with Bassegran.
Yeah, and there is a turf and ornamental label for that, too, and it is safe around quite a few species, not around sycamores and rhododendrons, but a bunch of other things.
Well, we're not talking about that. It's just clover and grass
is all
we care
about.
And
it is labeled for clover grown for seed and that kind of thing, and it's definitely not hurting grass.
Okay, so That's the whole thing, Larry. I would have mentioned Bassegran to you, but technically it's not labeled for every last clover and every grass out there. But what I can tell you with Bassegran is this. So both Darren and I have worked with this product for almost 40 years now. If you're going to spray it, don't expect control forever. Yes, you could spray it at the bud stage and it might be better, but I don't know that I can say I've ever really seen that. There have been guys that have talked about that, but I don't know if that actually is proven out. I would just say spray the thistles almost any time, but what you're after is it's got to be hot and humid. You need 150 points of heat plus humidity. So in other words, if it's 80 degrees out and 70% humidity, that would be a decent day to spray Bassegran. So you throw a quart of Bassegran and a quart of crop oil together. You're going to burn the clover just a little bit. You won't burn the grass hardly at all. But it's just not that great. That was all we used to have in soybeans for thistles. And we would go out and spot spray, and it'd burn them down to the ground some. Yeah. And then for the most part, they'd end up coming back. So I can't say that you're going to have any great success. I also can't tell you that it's labeled. So, I mean, for your specific clover and your specific grass, but it's not going to hurt the clover and it's not going to hurt the grass. So if you want to try that, that's totally up to you. Just don't count on a whole lot. I'd way rather, if you didn't have too many thistles out there, so you just go individually spot them with Roundup, that will permanently kill them.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that could be used would be Milestone, and I didn't even think about this, Darren, in your little backpack or four-wheeler if you got a tank and you just spot spray, because the Milestone will permanently kill the thistle and it will leave a lot of residual that Roundup won't leave, and you won't kill the grass. You might kill the clover in that spot, but that would be a decent way to go too if you didn't have, you know, you aren't just totally loaded with thistles. You go out there and hit a few spots, you'd kill, you know, a few plants of clover, but so what? You'd still leave the grass and at least you'd get the thistle under control. So those would probably be our best bets. And like I say, you can sure try that Bassegran deal if you want to. Both Darren and I are going to tell you it's not going to work fantastically well, but it's a heck of a lot better than nothing.
it never did work good that best year.
Nope.
It just made you look good that year. Next year, you,
yep.
I mean, it delayed the weeds, but it never really, and the beans overtook them. That's what I always thought of Bassegrain.
I agree. Yep, I agree.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thanks
okay,
for the call, Larry.
You
bet. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, let's go next to Ross out in Wisconsin. Hey, Ross, how are you doing today?
This is Ross Peterson, but actually I'm in Sheridan County, Wyoming.
Wyoming, sorry, Brent.
Yeah, well, yeah, they had Wisconsin up on my screen.
You confused,
here, so
you confused our sister. She always gets a good kick out of that if she gets that abbreviation wrong. Hey, Ross, thanks for calling. You sent a soil test in too, and just for a little background, tell us about the field. You said it's been long time alfalfa and grass.
I think for probably 130 years it's been raising alfalfa and grass, and it's probably the first soil test it's probably ever had.
Okay, well, hopefully it's not the last one. There's a lot of information on the soil test, and I looked. The soil pH looks like it's a little high. We're talking about upper sevens into low eights, which when we're raising alfalfa, it's better than too low, I guess, from that standpoint. And just looking at P and K levels, they're fairly low, which we would expect in a long-standing alfalfa crop because we just haven't had a chance to build those up. So talk to us about your fertility program. What do you normally put out there?
I have not put anything on it. So this is just, like I say, just plum natural, I guess you might say. And we chiseled it and disced it last fall because we're replanting, and so we disced it again this spring, and then I sent this soil sample in, and then I'm going to probably have to be planting some oats in it this year and then get it back into alfalfa 80% at least next round is the plan.
Yep. So. Okay. So, yeah, if it was me, I would do everything I could to build up the P and K now that you have a chance. And the whole deal is with – especially phosphorus, but even potassium, where you have a lower rainfall environment and heavy soil, they just don't move down in the soil very well. So if you can get them down in the ground a little bit, where those roots are going to be with the alfalfa, you're going to have better overall long-term success. So I would take a hard look at that. Yeah, in terms of the pH, I mean, we would tell you it's just a little bit high. And so I understand. Darren had a note down here. It was sub-irrigated by creek. This isn't irrigated.
Well,
it isn't. Or is it?
Well, no. Yeah, it is irrigated by side roll and pivot. So.
Okay. So it is irrigated by a pivot. I wondered when your sodium levels were not overly high, but they're getting up there. So, I mean, you're at 1% on sodium right now. So it's not terrible. We don't have a disaster on our hands right now or anything, but I worry a little about the water quality. So if it was me, I take a look at my water quality, and I'm just a little concerned that either the water quality's got to be improved or treated or get another source or improve the drainage a little bit, because it looks like your sodium levels are creeping up just a little bit. And so it's fine right now, like I say today, but I've seen this too many times in the past where all of a sudden you go 5-10 years and now you got 2 or 3% sodium and you're really hurting your alfalfa. So that's all I'd say is test your water. Just check that out. That's a concern for me. But yeah, for me, when I look at it, the first things that pop out to me is just a need for a little more phosphorus and especially potassium. Potassium, there are big needs for alfalfa, and you've got an opportunity now before you get that stand in next year to start building up your levels down below just a little bit. One other nutrient that alfalfa needs on a fairly regular basis is boron, and a lot of people talk about boron. Your levels aren't terrible. I'm happy to see your boron levels are up a little bit, but that's something that can kind of be added as you go, because boron and sulfur both can leach down through the ground a little bit. So you can keep adding boron and sulfur just about every year. But now is your chance to work on your phosphorus, your potassium. Looks like you need a little bit of zinc, maybe just a little bit of copper, and a little bit of manganese. So those are the things that I'd kind of be looking at. A little bit of sulfur certainly wouldn't help too. And if I was going to pick one type of sulfur, I'd pick elemental sulfur rather than some sulfate form like ammonium sulfate or gypsum or whatever. If you get even just a little bit of elemental sulfur, that'll help drive your pH down just a hair. And that's a good long-term form of sulfur for you to buy. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but that's probably what I would do when I'm picking a source of sulfur.
Okay, and then so on the soil test, it says VH. Does that mean that it's high, or is it?
Well,
after the parched ferment.
Yep, VH is going to stand for very high, but that's just their particular ratings on something. That doesn't necessarily mean all that much, but just compared to the average, that may be considered high.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So yeah, okay. You've got some spots where, you know, there it looks like you have some phosphorus in the ground, just not all available because of the pH, and also sometimes it just takes time to come available. So those P2 numbers are fairly high in a few spots, but certainly in some other spots you'd need a little bit more. Ross, if you want to talk more, just hang on for us. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
When it comes to trusted herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. And you certainly know Nufarm exclusive Weedmaster. For decades, Weedmaster has been the go-to herbicide for consistent burndown weed control in a huge variety of crops, and in range and pasture management too. Don't let yield-robbing weeds stand in the way of your progress or profits. Nufarm and Weedmaster Herbicide, here to help.
Imagine the perfect flow of grain from the field to the bin. Imagine a single rotor that ensures both quality and productivity. An advanced system that optimizes harvest settings on the go. You don't have to imagine. With features like AFS Harvest Command, an axial flow combine from Case IH always delivers the perfect flow for your operation. Find out how. Talk to your Case IH dealer today.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean fields, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer amaranth. Take control of your soybean fields and get incentives from Bayer Plus Rewards when you choose the power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Increase your productivity with Hypro's Dual React Control System. The dual nozzle body design allows you to drive at the speed you want while maintaining the rate and droplet size you need. Hypro, helping you spray better.
How much yield did you lose the moment you planted your seed? Introducing the Germinator Closing Wheel from Farm Shop MFG. Designed and built by a farmer tired of seeing yield loss from poor stands, the Germinator gives your crop the strong start it needs for maximum yield. Visit farmshopmfg.com.
Your land is a legacy, a challenge from those who tended it before you, to build on their foundations. At Corteva Agriscience, we understand what it means to be the stewards of a legacy. We embrace the challenge of building on the foundation of Dow AgroSciences to maintain your trust, to bring new solutions, to help you care for your land. See how we can help build your legacy at rangeandpasture.com.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Thanks for listening today to Ag PhD Radio. I am Brian Hefty, along with my brother Darren. We're broadcasting today from the Morton studio, just talking a little bit about shelter belts, but got into a discussion right before the break with Ross from Wyoming about alfalfa. Now, I pulled up during the break our Ag PhD fertilizer removal app, and I took a look at alfalfa, and I just wanted to let you know this, and I'll actually just give you on a 1 ton of dry matter. Keep in mind, this is a ton of dry matter. How much or how many nutrients alfalfa actually removes from the soil? So for phosphate, it's 12 pounds. So it's not a ridiculously huge number, but still, it's 12. You start multiplying that out times how many tons you're going to pull off per year and how many years you have the stand, and figuring the fact that phosphorus doesn't move well in soil. In other words, if I lay it on the soil surface, it's not going to move down with rain or anything. It's going to stay up at or near the soil surface for years and years and years. So it'd probably be a good idea to have a fair amount of phosphorus out there. But here's the big one, potassium. K2O potassium, for every 1 ton of dry matter, you pull out 49 pounds of K2O potassium. So you start multiplying that times, you know, however many tons you're going to pull off per year, times how many years you're going to leave that stand out there, it is a lot of potassium. I'd also throw out 5.4 pounds of sulfur per ton. I guess those are the main ones that you need to know. So phosphate, potassium, sulfur. Like I said, sulfur is easy to add a little bit as you go. So is boron, because they're leachable nutrients. No big deal. But the P and the K, now's the chance. Now's your opportunity before you go into this long-term stand to get those things done. Ross, what else did you have for questions?
Well, just a quick observation on my exchange capacity. How does that look to you?
Okay. So when we say, you're talking about your cation exchange capacity?
Right.
Yes. So what I see here is 19.9 on the low end up to 29.1 on the high end, which would tell us that it's fairly heavy soil. We typically say 20 and above, we consider that a heavy soil. So it's not, you know, ridiculously heavy or anything, but it's just fairly heavy soil. On average, you've got about 3.2% organic matter, let's call it. So, I mean, that is certainly not too bad, especially for your area. So I like that. And, you know, with this cation exchange capacity, you got fairly heavy ground. The advantage to heavy ground is you can go at least maybe a few extra days where your soil can continue to provide water for your plants and nutrients for your plants. So that's good. It's just, if we're going to move nutrients through the soil profile, that's why I was saying, like potassium, when you're talking a 20, 25, 30 CEC to try to move potassium through the soil profile, it just doesn't happen very fast. It can happen, but it's just not real quick. And when I look at what you've got for base saturation K, you're in the 1.8 to 3 range, so we would call all of those very low. And the parts per million of potassium, you've got, let's see what I'm looking, oh, I guess there are two pages here. Let's see, it looks like 160 roughly up to 250 or so parts per million of potassium, and we would also call that low for a long-term stand of alfalfa. So if I was going to invest in something here, number one would be potassium, number two would be at least a little bit of phosphorus. You don't have to get carried away, but some phosphorus, especially in those areas of the fields where you're down to 19 and 29 parts per million on your P2. You know, beyond that, little sulfur, you know, a few of these little micronutrients. So no real big deal, but P and K for sure.
And so where is the best way to get an idea on like on micronutrients, how much person needs to put on? Where do I find that information?
Okay, well, first of all, on that AgPHD fertilizer removal app you could download for your smartphone, that comes from the international, that's information that comes from the International Plant Nutrition Institute, and you could look up alfalfa, and based on your tonnage that you think you're going to remove, it'll tell you how many tons, or I should say how many pounds of micronutrients you're going to pull off. What we're looking for a lot of times is, what do you have to begin with? And when I look at boron, and you're on average 1.2, 1.3 parts per million, that's actually a fairly decent place to start. I'm probably not too worried about boron this year in your oat year. And next year, if you want to throw out just a little bit, you can, but it doesn't take a lot of boron. It's just, as we all know, alfalfa needs a little boron. Your copper is down around 1. Copper is a nutrient that's really important for disease tolerance in every crop. And usually we're trying to get it up to 2 parts per million, you know, 1.5 to 2 parts per million. You do that and you're in good shape for the life of the stand. I'm not too worried. Zinc, you're down at 1 part per million or less. And usually what we look for is a phosphorus to zinc ratio. So generally speaking, we're talking 10 to 1 ratio phosphorus to zinc. So let's say we were at 100 parts per million on phosphorus, we'd be talking 10 parts per million on zinc. And so, you know, at a minimum, we like to see 2 or 3 parts per million on zinc. So you could certainly add a little bit of zinc. It's not that expensive or anything else. Just get that up. But zinc is a nutrient very much like phosphorus where it doesn't leach. So it's once you get it in the soil, it's going to stay where it's put until your crop eventually uses it. So that's why, you know, when you're talking heavy ground, and if it's ground you own, your investments in phosphorus, potassium, and zinc are things that they're never leaving that field as long as you don't have, you know, big time soil erosion. If you just get it down in the ground a little bit, then it's not going to leach away. It's going to be there until eventually your crop uses it. So that's why, as a farmer myself, I don't mind investing in phosphorus, potassium, and zinc. They're there until I eventually use them in heavy ground.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that gives me a real good place to start. I appreciate it.
You bet. Yeah, thanks for the call, Ross. Good luck.
You bet. You bet.
All right. I got a question. This one is from Scott in Central Alabama.
Oh, hey, wait a second. Before we get to questions, were we doing questions earlier?
We were.
Oh, okay. I wanted to just say with... I didn't think we'd hit Ag PhD mailbag. Maybe we had.
We did. I'm losing it in the first segment. Brian.
Oh yeah, in first segment. That's right. Anyway, wrapping up on the shelter belt thing, I wanted to make sure that we had time to talk about that. In terms of our recommendations for shelter belts, just a few quick things. First of all, if you're going to put in a new shelter belt, that's your opportunity. Just like we were talking about Ross's long-term stand of alfalfa, I think the exact same way with a shelter belt. I want to see that potassium level at 7 or 8%. With trees. Trees need a crazy amount of potassium. Put it out there. Your trees are going to need it. Usually your shelter belt's only 1 acre or 2 or 3 acres. You're not going to spend crazy amounts of total dollars, but you're going to think that I'm nuts, but there are cases where you might need 1,000 pounds of potash or more. Get it out there. Load it up. Do it in advance of putting that shelter belt in. It will absolutely help your trees. Same kind of thing with phosphorus. You don't have to get too carried away with phosphorus, but load up your P and K to begin with. Now is your chance. You're not doing a lot of acres in a shelter belt anyway, so get that done. Then you can put on nutrients like nitrogen, sulfur, boron every single year. So that's the fertility side. In terms of treating that shelter belt for insects or mites, that's really important. So like on our farm here, we will spray our trees every year with a miticide like acephate, zeal. I mean, there are a bunch of different miticides out there, and we're even doing a combination of a couple different ones. You can also use a fungicide at that time. So I know we've used Bravo, and I mean, there are a few fungicides that can be used. We want to do everything we can to make sure our tree belts are in good shape. We don't have a lot of acres or anything, but it's something, you know, just about every farmer, just about every person who owns an acreage in the country is proud of, is their trees. You can make them look good, and it doesn't cost that much money. In terms of weed control in the shelter belt, a lot of people ask us about 2,4-D, but we hate the volatility of 2,4-D. There is a new 2,4-D called Freelix. So if you can find any of that, that'd be great. That's what I would use. Otherwise, if you have a volatile 2,4-D, spray it in the early spring or the late fall so you're not dropping leaves off the trees. You're not going to kill the tree, but you might drop the leaves off in the spring and your leaves aren't going to come back till the following year. So if you don't want your trees looking bad for a year and getting stunted, then don't be spraying 2,4-D in the middle of the summer when it's 90 degrees out. I don't think you're going to be happy if it's the old volatile 2,4-D. There are a lot of people that will spray Roundup in through their shelter belts and just literally kill everything. But at some point, you're probably going to want to grow some grass in there. And that's where afterwards, then a lot of people are spraying 2,4-D. Be careful what you're using for herbicides, because there are certainly some that will damage trees. I think about things like Toradon and Milestone, just a couple that, you know, many people will use out in pastures. So just be real careful about what you're using around those trees. We want to make sure they're in great shape for the long term.
All right. Well, we've run out of time for more mailbag questions. We'll get to more of those on tomorrow's program. I want to thank all of our guests we had on today. I had some great information about spraying in shelter belts. Hopefully that helped you on your operation. Thanks for listening to our show today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio. And now stay tuned for Rob Sharkey and Shark Farmer Radio.